Before we dive into the episode, make sure you hit subscribe on the podcast platform you're listening on. Also, follow me on X at The Dave Dynasty and subscribe on YouTube by looking up Nostalgic Dave Dynasty. You can also buy one of my shirts at ProWrestlingTees.com/TheDaveDynasty. Now, enjoy the show.
Welcome to 1 hour of the toughest, roughest wrestling you'll ever see.
That's right, Dick the Bruiser, set it off.
The big question, have you got the endurance? Have you got the brains to get past the excellence of execution?
Where are all the gutless American wrestlers? Step in the ring with the Baron and face the brains.
The reason why Axe and myself were put on this earth is to demolish people.
Bobby Heenan, that is a very good-looking sport coat you've got on.
Yeah, and I paid for mine. Mine is in government issue.
Hello, everybody. Lance Russell and Dave Brown right along ringside. By golly, we're ready to go with another big week of championship wrestling.
Greetings, wrestling fans, and welcome to Wrestling Nostalgia. I am your host, Dave Dynasty. Thank you for joining me for another episode. We have a great guest today. On this episode, we have Mike Quackenbush. Mike was an indie wrestling standout in the mid-90s into the 2000s, who later founded Chikara and trained countless wrestlers. We'll talk about all these things with Mike later in the show. I remember first hearing about Mike in wrestling magazines. It was primarily about his matches with Reckless Youth, which we talk about as well. And to me, he was a known talent in wrestling without a major promotion backing him up, which was very, very unique at that time. He was very trend-setting, ahead of the curve, however you want to put it. What a guy he is, an absolute delight of an interview and a fascinating chat. So let's take a break, and we'll come back, and we can dive right into it with Mike Quackenbush.
Hey guys, Ray Russell here, curator of the WrestleCopia Podcast Network, inviting you guys to listen to many of the programs here as part of the WrestleCopia brand, including, but not limited to, the Wrestling Memory Grenade, currently covering the 1988 and the WWF project. You can also listen to the Regional Wrestling Podcast, where we talk the territories, whether it's Jamie Ward with Georgia 81, Roman Gomez with the UWF in 1986, or Gene Jackson covering Memphis in 85. Three projects going on right now over there at Regional Wrestling. You can also listen to The Wrestling Stoop with the legend himself, Bob Roop. Bob goes back in time each and every week, covering not just his career, but countless stories and interactions with hundreds of wrestling names spanning his two decades in the business. But that's not all. You can also check out the Puro Wrestling Academy with the professor of Puro Resu, Mr. Dan Ginnity. Dan and I go back in time and cover the history of Japanese professional wrestling in the English language. And you can listen to all of those shows and more, all part of the WrestleCopia Podcast Network, located over at WrestleCopia.com. That's WrestleCopia.com, and anywhere your podcast streaming needs are met, from Apple to Spotify, Pocket Cast, and beyond. And while you're at it, why not subscribe to our social media guys for all the latest goings on here at the WrestleCopia Podcast Network? Plus, I'm constantly adding old school video clips and pictures from throughout wrestling history. You can follow us over on X, formerly Twitter, at Wrestling Grenade. That's at R-A-S-S-L-I-N Grenade. Also, follow and like me, Facebook.com/Wrestling Grenade. And why not subscribe to YouTube.com/Wrestling Grenade? So if you're looking to support that next up-and-coming podcast brand, please consider making it WrestleCopia.
This is Listen to Their Screams, a horror podcast that feels like you're chatting with friends. Hello, I am one of your friends, Dave. I am one of the co-hosts of Listen to Their Screams with my friend Ike, and we want you to come and check us out. We are a fun-filled, positive horror movie podcast that does reviews, news, birthdays, anniversaries. We play games. We are a ton of fun every week for you, the horror fan out there. For all of our links to our social media and the podcast platforms, just check out our link tree. It is linktr.ee/listen2screams. That is listen, the number 2, and screams. Or look us up on your favorite social media platform and podcast provider. And welcome back to Wrestling Nostalgia. This time I'm being joined by Mike Quackenbush. Mike, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm very, very good. Let's dive into the... You are known prominently in wrestling for your training and your influence on training. You train countless wrestlers at the Wrestle Factory. Your training methods are used and have impacted the WWE Performance Center. However, when you started the business in 1994, you were untrained. That's very ironic, don't you think?
Indeed it is, in the true sense, not the Alanis Morissette sense.
That's right, yeah.
No, you're exactly right. But I think coming in like that and feeling like, by and large, I wasted my first 3 years in wrestling for lack of just not knowing what I was doing, making every mistake possible, it gave me an appreciation for how valuable good training is. It's indispensable.
Sure, yeah. And and you did get, after you got started, you got a little training with Ace Darling, correct? I mean, he kind of guided you a little bit, took you under his wing.
That's right. Yeah. Trained with Ace as well as his frequent traveling mate, Devin Storm, who's still active to this day as Crowbar. Yep. Yep. And then one by one, I kind of found other people either to coach me or mentor me along the way. And even now, I'm still looking for whether they're new ideas or concepts or things out there. Because I'm a big believer in you're really never done training. And the moment that you are, you've consigned yourself to obsolescence.
Yeah. I've always viewed guys like you, like Reckless Youth, Ace Darling, a handful of other guys, as the guys that established what independent wrestling is today.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely. I mean, you were all over the magazines, right? I mean, you were getting coverage without the backing of a major company. I mean, you were, I knew who you were. And you weren't on, McTV every week because of the magazines thing. You guys were displaying a new style in the ring that was not common. You were starting to gain some notoriety, but you were doing it in this very DIY method on your own. Did you set out with that mentality? I mean, did you have that punk rock mentality going into it? Or did it just kind of develop and, hey, this is what I've got to do. And so this is what I'm going to do.
Well, something that always kind of attracted me to wrestling was that it was pretty rock and roll back in the day. I think it has a lot less of those elements now than it did back then, but there was something very attractive about that. And living so close, I live about 45 minutes from Philadelphia. I have for the majority of my life. To be that close to what in the 90s was like the epicenter of the alternative wrestling scene, That gravity was inescapable. ECW was such a statement of this is what post-territory era wrestling can and should be. Well, everyone then kind of felt like I got to go out and make my own flavor, right? Like in the same way that Nirvana wasn't all of grunge, ECW wasn't all of independent wrestling, but we were figuring it out as we went. Right. So I think to answer your question very directly, I don't know that it was so much like this is what our mission is or this is our goal, but us like desperately fumbling through the dark, hoping to be like, is this it? Are we doing it? No. Yeah. What about this? You know?
Yeah. I mean, and like I said, though, I think that laid the foundation for a lot of guys today because there are lots of guys out there doing the independent thing, developing their own brand, setting their own bookings, doing it the way they need to and making a career of it, right? Living off of it. And you guys were doing that at a time it was really much more difficult, right? You didn't have social media, things like that to help promote yourself and everything else. And so how do you do that in that day and age? I mean, you're mailing tapes? Is it word of mouth? Is it just showing up and show? I mean, how are you approaching it at that time period?
You're right. It's a little of all of the above. That you're spot on about that. Your ability to do interpersonal networking was king. If you couldn't have a polite, respectful, professional conversation with another human being. And don't get me wrong, like we all come into wrestling a little bit damaged. That's how we got here, right? Like they don't let you in the door otherwise. But you've got to learn how to place all of your social awkwardness and other anxieties aside and try and make meaningful connections. And sometimes that's done by sweeping out the ring beforehand, hoping that there's an opportunity, or sometimes it's done at the diner late at night after, the ring's already been packed away, hoping to make an impression with somebody who has influence one town over, somebody who has influence over a promotion that will feature young, unestablished talent, and then waiting, right? It's like planting seeds and seeing what will sprout. And sometimes a demo tape with your wrestling resume attached, it wouldn't sprout right away. But 6 months later, you'd get a phone call and say, I think I saw your demo reel months ago. Mm-hmm. And now I can't believe I'm seeing you here on a show in the middle of Nowheresville, Ohio. You want to come a little further to Indiana? You want to come a little further to Michigan? Are you willing to drive to Milwaukee? And then little by little, you know, you kind of creep your way out there.
Yeah. Well, it, like I said, I knew of you guys, right, through magazines and everything else, even though, and I did tape trading, so I saw some of your stuff and everything else, but it's not like it was readily available.
No, you had to seek it out.
You had to work, yeah. Yeah, and in my mind, though, I mentioned him earlier, but when I think Mike Quackenbush, I almost immediately think of Reckless Youth for numerous reasons, but particularly, I mean, you guys kind of ran the circuit together, right? I mean, you traveled together. You put your match out there everywhere, and I think that helped get you a lot of attention, right? You two working together. I mean, how key do you feel that you and Reckless Youth are to each other and your development?
I think in the late 90s, the vast majority of opportunities I was afforded were because of Reckless Youth, Tom Carter, because promoters would call up and book us as a peanut butter and jelly match. Yeah. That's not to say that I wouldn't occasionally get a booking on my own. Of course, Reckless got his own bookings, but more times than not, a promoter would call up and say, you know, we want the peanut butter and jelly match. So bring, you know, both guys is what we're looking for. So the fact that we fell into that kind of, you know, binary orbit with each other was very helpful, especially to me, because I was not perceived as being on Tom's level in the late 90s. And when I think back to that period of time, I don't put myself on his level, even though I started earlier. Those three wasted years of mine allowed people to rocket past me. And in the ring, Tom was far more accomplished, far more confident, and he really understood who he was as Reckless Youth. So I was very content at times to just kind of trail behind him and do the very best that I could, because it was opening doors for me. And the same was true, you know, if I was often booked on with Ace or booked on with Don Montoya or whomever, I was lucky enough that I was often put in the ring with people who, one, they would protect and take care of me in an era where if a veteran performer did not particularly like you, one, being on the lighter side, right? I've almost always wrestled as a junior heavyweight or lightweight or cruiserweight, however you'd like to think of it, right? It wouldn't take much for a big old grizzled veteran to just beat me to a pulp. And that'd be the whole match. The whole match would just be me getting beaten up. So one, I had guys that were protecting me, but also were very interested and were motivated by the idea of, can we steal the show? And I see that as a major shift that's occurred from where I was at then to, you know, when I'm out and about now. There's so much less talk about, like, let's be the match that steals the show, and a lot more about, like, I hear these kind of conversations. What's going to sell me more t-shirts? Can we plan something that's going to go viral? Right. Where the focus is has really shifted in the current era. And I'm not trying to say that's good or bad, but it's harder for me to relate to that, having come up with placing such value on, if we can be the best match on the show, that is our only job tonight. And let's do it to the best of our ability.
Yeah. And like I said, you know, you guys obviously helped develop an in-ring style, but you, especially you, you've always had a lot of emphasis though on storytelling, right? And that side of it, coming into it, you've got lots of books out there, but in your one book, Toolbox, Building Better Pro Wrestling, which came out in 2020, you talk about the art of a wrestling match built in three acts.
Yes.
And in one chapter, you discuss how you build that match when it's two faces, right? When you don't have a heel in that match and how you do that. And you say that you can achieve the same thing with one of the faces in the second act acting as the aggressor.
Yes.
And then one point that you, I love that you brought up, that you brought up this paper, which lays out the point that the illusion of deception lies in the mental habits of the viewer. And that's such it's interesting, right? Because people think of magic or illusion as the sleight of hand, what the person's doing, but you're really relying on the perception of the person.
Yes.
More than what you're doing. That's what you're playing. That's what you're working with and against. So talk to me a little about that, because I've never really seen it from that perspective. But that's absolutely 100% true.
Yes. And, you know, one, thank you for that. And thanks for mentioning Toolbox, Building Better Pro Wrestling. Thank you very much.
Sure.
But yeah, you're exactly right. And in this day and age, I think how this has changed the way that I teach wrestling. There is so much wrestling being made every week, more than any person could consume. So if you really wanted to, you could just watch dozens and dozens of new hours of WWE, AEW, Ring of Honor, MLW, Billy Corgan's NWA, blah, 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 right? We could just name them all day long and we still wouldn't get to them all.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
People now, they recognize patterns. They have certain habits and expectations about wrestling. And the same is kind of true if we look at, you know, like prestidigitation and how misdirection works when you're doing sleight of hand tricks. Yep. So if you understand the underlying ideas, it's just a matter of how you manifest that in the ring. And after having done wrestling for as long as I have, and you may find your brain does this as well, just by the fact that you're able to talk so fluently about what wrestling was like in the 90s tells me you've been watching for a while, Dave. I have this funny feeling about you.
Sure.
Yeah. once you've been doing it for so long, right, you see the nuts and bolts inside the machine. So you don't kind of see what faces outward, what the audience perception is. You see the underlying parts and you realize how they must work together to get the end result. So when you can see inside the machine like that, in the same way that if you studied, for example, like I think the art of screenwriting, when you sit and watch a movie, well, yeah, you might really love the actors and you might love the set pieces and you might love the soundtrack. But underneath it, you're like, well, this is all just act one. And here we go, right? This is the rising action in act two, right? And we're going to get to the climax here in a bit. And it's a little bit of that with wrestling as well, that you just start to kind of see the cogs inside of the machine. And then you realize I can get the right reaction, even if it's two baby faces. I can get the reaction that I need, even if it's two heels, without damaging either character in any way. The trick is to look at it at that deeper level, to kind of like take the magician's point of view, right? You're inside of this thing, crafting it to face forward for the audience. You can no longer be out in the seats looking at it and expect that you're going to understand that fully. And I realize that turned into an expansive and rambling kind of answer there.
No,
but
okay.
That is kind of part of the job, I think, for us to craft it in the ring if we're doing right by the paying customers. If people are willing to pay money for a ticket, when there is a near ubiquity and unending variety of wrestling to be watched on anyone's smartphone at any point in time, and yet we have someone so dedicated that they would drive to some filthy little arena somewhere, figure out where to park or how to navigate it through public transit, give us their money, and sit in the seats, we better craft the best possible story for them. It is not enough to just say, here's the pile of moves I learned at practice last week. We've got to give them a real story and a compelling experience worth the value of the ticket. Or sooner or later, we're going to end up playing to more empty seats than full ones.
Yep. Well, right. It references back to the fact that at its core, wrestling is emotion driven, right? It's a,
yes,
like anything else. It's you're using and utilizing your audience's emotions. And that's what you're trying to build. And if you do that, right, the audience can overlook some of the moves, some of the misses. They don't notice that because of what they're feeling.
Right.
And
that's more times than not, right? That is exactly what makes us ardent fans. We saw an angle, we heard a promo, we watched a match, and it made us feel something, right? A very visceral feeling. And whether or not, like, that match was technically correct or whatever, virtually irrelevant. The sure. Ultimate Warrior is testament to this, right?
Right.
No technical masterpieces to speak of. And yet he was able to make tens of thousands or hundreds or millions of people feel something with the way that he performed. And we should all be so lucky as to be able to evoke similar emotion from wrestling fans.
Yeah. Yeah. And one aspect of your career that you're obviously most known for is that you and Reckless Youth founded Chikara in 2002. So talk to us about, why did you decide to open a promotion? And what was your mission going into Chikara? Why did you feel that the professional world needed that?
Well, so At that time, Reckless Youth Tom Carter had just kind of come out of a WWF developmental deal. So he had been down in their then developmental territory. So traveling backwards in time, this is long before NXT is formed. It's before FCW even existed, the forerunner to NXT, right? That was overseen by Steve Kern and Norman Smiley.
Yep.
So in the 90s, their developmental system was kind of floating around. And at the time, it lived in Memphis under the direction of a guy named Terry Golden. They had signed Reckless to a deal, and he was down there 12 to 18 months, give or take, during which period of time it felt like they constantly were changing direction on him. They would say, well, we see you as a heel. You know what? We think you might be better as a manager. Could you grow your hair out? Could you gain some weight? Could you lose some weight? You know, we liked you better when you were bald. They just kept changing directions, and he found this to be exhausting. When he came back out of his developmental deal, having never made his debut on television, I think a lot of his passion for wrestling had been beaten out of him. And we thought, what's the thing that we love best? And as fellow tape traders, it was when we would get a tape from Mexico that just seemed so unlike anything we had in the U.S. When we would watch a Super J Cup from Japan, and it was so unlike the wrestling we had in the U.S. or from Britain, or you name it. When we would see foreign wrestling, it just lit us up. We were inspired by this. Like, how do we make it like that? Or how do we do this? And that was what led us oftentimes to trying to train with people. Tom got to train a little bit with William Regal while he was in developmental, or we got to train with Super Crazy and learn some lucha that way. And we thought, let's come up with something that really celebrates these international flavors as much as it celebrates American pro wrestling. Because it's not as if we don't also love that stuff. I can't get enough of the Papa Shango's and the Max Moons and the Repo Mans, please. But the thing that was going on at the time, you go back to 2002, this is just after WCW and ECW have been gobbled up by the McMahon machine. This is, you know, late period attitude era. A lot of the wrestling that's being made could be thought of as being an R-rated adult product. And that definitely informed the direction we wanted to go with Chikara, in that we did not want parents to feel embarrassed to bring their kids and enjoy the show. And we also didn't want kids, if they brought grandma, for grandma's intelligence to be insulted, because chances are, right, she might have grown up with Gorgeous George or Lou Thesz or Nature Boy Buddy Rogers. So we had to have a little something for everybody and bake in these international spices that we really liked. And in the beginning, that was all the plan there was.
Well, when you went into it, right, it goes back to some of the things we talked about earlier with characters, right? Chikara is definitely known for its characters, but it goes back to that, the storytelling that we talked about. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to break up another one of your books, the 7 Ways to Becoming a Better Performer in 2017. Mm-hmm. You talk about, and you touched on this a little earlier, I believe, but you talk about rituals in professional wrestling and repetition. And you talked about that earlier, how that you're setting that baseline to try to get people to react. To control the people and their emotions, and you discuss how they're positive things, right? That you can, because what you're doing is you're teaching the crowd, right? Mm-hmm. When to respond to you, and that plays into how you get over as a wrestler. So talk to us a little bit about that, because you're right, because you mentioned John Cena and the quote unquote 5 moves of doom are not the, obviously not the most, like we said earlier, not the most technical of moves,
right?
But when the crowd sees them, they know how to react, and they do.
Yes. So especially thinking about character ritual for just a second, which I think is an essential piece for any wrestler to have. And I think it's more important now than it was 30, 40 years ago, which isn't to say there aren't examples from back then of guys who were already doing that. But it is some element of interactivity where the audience gets to play along and they know their role. It's something that they kind of look forward to. And it only really comes from this wrestler, right? There's only one thing, right? When Daniel Bryan is coming down the rampway and he's doing this with his fingers, the audience knows exactly what they're supposed to do. And they know that they don't do that for Randy Orton. They don't do that for Bray Wyatt. They only do this for Daniel Bryan. That bit of interactivity is super valuable. And you're right. The only way that gets established or taught to the audience is through repetition. Sometimes, and I went through this a lot, I often feared repetition would make me boring.
Yeah.
But the truth is, you are teaching it to a new audience every single night. And if your priority is that relationship with the live audience, which is one key way I differentiate pro wrestling from sports entertainment, If your relationship is with the audience, not with a camera, then you've got to teach it to every audience every single night. And it's more important for an independent who doesn't have any TV equity from years of Raw or SmackDown or whatever to really emphasize that part of the game, because it will be more unique than any move you could ever do. You know, when we think of like some moves which definitely had their moments in the sun, the Canadian Destroyer was unique to Petey Williams for about 3 weeks. And then on week four, it was already on a dozen different independent wrestling shows being done everywhere. Having something as cool as the Canadian Destroyer, it might make you unique for about a week in the social media era of wrestling, but it won't be yours for long. But a character ritual that's unique to you is a one-on-one relationship with the audience. They only get that ability to interact and play from your character, and it's ultimately more valuable than any move you could ever learn.
Yeah. And diving into your career, you've often talked about how Jushin Liger was your idol, mm-hmm. your primary influence, a reason you wanted to wrestle.
Yes.
Well, in 2010, you were able to wrestle Liger mm-hmm. for Jersey All-Pro. What, talk to us about what that's like, because all of us have idols, right? All of us have, not all of us get to interact and do that thing with our idol. So what was that like?
You know, I'm sure you've heard the old adage that you should never meet your heroes, right? Yep. For any yep. reason, right? They're bound to disappoint you, or you imagine they're somehow superhuman, but you know what? We're all just people at the end of the day, or whatever, whatever the reason might be. And I am so fortunate to be an example to the contrary in that I got to meet, with the exception of Owen Hart, I got to meet all of my in-ring heroes, and they were all awesome. I don't know what more I could possibly have asked for. So when Jersey All-Pro gave me that opportunity to be in the ring with Jushin Liger, I was very skeptical. I had been promised matches with big name wrestlers in the past. There was a promoter who for years kept floating to me, I'm going to put you in the ring with Taka Michinoku. Well, that never happened. I'm going to put you in the ring with Dr. Wagner Jr. at a time when he was one of the top stars in Mexico. That never happened. So I was a little skeptical about this whole Jushin Liger thing, because it really was very, very near and dear to my heart. And wrestling will often find ways to break your heart. And so until I actually saw him in the building, I don't think I really believed it was going to happen. And when I did see him emerge from his private dressing room in the full-on Liger suit, I mean, that's as close to meeting any celebrity, rock star, or movie star, anything you can imagine for me, because of his deep significance to my own story. That's the guy that made me want to do this. And the thing that really struck me about that day was, he said to me, and he speaks better English than he lets on in most interviews. he said to me, I am absolutely wrecked from the travel getting here. I'm so tired. My body's beat. It would really mean a lot to me if you could just design this match. Tell me where to plug in my stuff. I'm sure you know what my moves are. If you would take that responsibility for me, it would mean a lot today. I really need to rest. And he went back into his private dressing room, and I thought, I think perhaps part of it was colored by this. I imagined this would not be the only match we would ever have. And as opponents, it is. We tagged once later on, but I thought, what is the best gift I can give to someone who has already given so much to me, whether he knows it or not? And I thought, I want him to feel like he has the night off. I want to give him the easiest possible night in the ring. When I look back on that now, I think maybe I should have pushed a little harder. Maybe the dream that I'd had about what it would be like to wrestle Liger and what that match might have contained, maybe I should have pushed harder for that. But I opted in that moment to think, I'm going to design a match that gives my hero the night off. When it was all said and done, and that's not to say that I was not pleased, but when it was all said and done, he paid me one of the best compliments I've ever been paid. He said, I would love for us to have a chance to do this match again one day in Japan. And for the guy who is the reason that I wanted to take this up and do it, to say something like that to me, was as edifying and validating probably as any compliment I've ever been paid. I feel so fortunate, whether it was Liger, Johnny Saint, Eddie Guerrero, Manami Toyota, the 1-2-3 Kid, that I got to have interpersonal experiences with them, to share the ring with them, to learn from all of them, and to discover they are every bit as awesome as I had imagined. And I think when you can just see them as a fellow traveler on the road of wrestling, who's just further ahead than you are, who's maybe got some stories to share, and maybe who you happen to like a whole bunch of their matches, it's easy to get along with these people and to see them for who they are.
Yeah. Yeah. And we talked earlier about your influence on training, right? Mm-hmm. And you've had a couple stints with WWE in training and production.
That's right.
What is it like? Do you take pride in having worked and influenced their training program and been there, but you never really worked for them as a talent, right? A lot of times right. They bring back former talent. What, I mean, that's gotta be a prideful moment that you had that much impact on the business that even though you had no connection to that company, that you were brought in for those stints.
I appreciate those very kind words, but I think to be frank about it, I don't take pride in much of my own work at all. I just don't. Having said as much, I found it very peculiar, you know, between 2016 and the summer of 2019, I was doing, whether it was coaching or creative work or whatever for WWE. And even before I got there, because one of my own trainees, Sarah Amato, took over as one of the coaches down there, my training system was already baked into the DNA of the Performance Center by the time I first set foot on their floor. It's not lost on me how peculiar it is to have had that level of influence and yet have never wrestled a match for the WWE in my entire life. Mm-hmm. And the reality is, most times, it just filled me with a complete sense of imposter syndrome. I was like, what am I doing here? Like, I don't belong here. Like, these other coaches, that guy was on WrestleMania. This guy's wrestled in the Tokyo Dome. This guy sold out all these arenas. Like, what am I doing here? That is how I felt most days. I always kind of just felt like I don't really belong here. But I tried really hard not to let it show.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I think you're a little over humble, right? I mean, you've wrestled in virtually every prominent independent promotion there is, right? I mean, CZW, we can list them off, Ring of Honor, IWA Mid-South, Dragon Gate, on and on and on and on. You mentioned a few, you've wrestled so many talents, right? So many guys who have done so much in this business. Outside, we talked about the Jushin Liger thing, and you mm-hmm. talked about a few other names. Does anything else really jump out as memorable from your career? Whether it be from a technical standpoint of the match, a humorous standpoint, you know what I mean? Something that's, you know, an ironic standpoint, whatever it is. When you look back in your career, is there a particular something that jumps out into your mind immediately?
Well, I'm lucky in that I've had so many different facets to what I've done, right? There's the period of 10 years where I worked for the magazines. I'm writing for Pro Wrestling Illustrated and the sister titles there. So there's parts of that jump out. There's parts of, now I've trained over 1,000 wrestlers. So there's parts from that kind of jump out. There's the in-ring stuff that I've done. There's the, you know, the books that I've done or my YouTube project or whatever. Each of them has their own kind of thing. But I suppose it's the moments where I really connected with someone who had a significant influence or impact on me that really always stand out as like, that's something I'm going to hang on to until my brain just doesn't function anymore. I think about, for example, in February of 2002, I was lucky enough to be booked on against Eddie Guerrero up in Lynn, Massachusetts, during a brief period of time where he's back on the independents. I think maybe he'd had a DUI or something, and WWE had put him in the penalty box, but they were about to bring him back up to TV. And for me, this was quite significant. The series of matches Eddie Guerrero and Dean Malenko had in WCW, or ECW actually, prior to their WCW run, are among the very best I think ever wrestled.
Yep.
I could go back and watch those infinitely and never tire of them, which is not to poo-poo their later matches. I don't mean it that way, but it's something about that series in ECW that really just resonated with me. Like I watch those and I'm like, that's my Abbey Road. If I can only take one Beatles album with me to a desert island, it's Abbey Road. If I can only take one, it's Eddie and Dean. Well, we happened to wrestle up in Lynn, Massachusetts. And afterward, we just sat in the back, kind of coming down off the performance high of being in the ring, and we're all sweaty messes. And while we were out there, I mean, I'm sure it was obvious to everyone in the audience, I was utterly outclassed by this guy. Eddie Guerrero, when he's on, there are very, very few wrestlers in the world who could keep up with him. I certainly could not. And I said to him, I realize you did not have to work as hard as you did tonight for 250 fans to make me look good for 18 straight minutes. I just want you to know, I know how hard you were working, and it really does mean a lot to me that you did that for me. And he said, here's something I learned from my father, Gory Guerrero, that I want to impart to you. If I went out there to the ring tonight and I made up my mind that I was going to make you out in front of these fans to be an absolute zero, and then I beat you. Who did I beat? Mm-hmm. A zero, a nobody. And we did nothing. We built nothing. We always have to make each other look awesome. I am only as awesome as you make me look, and you are only as awesome as I make you look. But together, we make wrestling awesome. It's us together. That lesson remains indelibly marked on my mind, and it's something I still impart to people as I train each and every week. I'm back in the ring or doing my online lecture series through Zoom or whatever. However I'm reaching out and teaching people, that lesson is never faded from my mind.
Yeah, it's the old adage, right? You hear about promos, right? Don't cut your opponent down too much in promos, because then if you beat him, what have you done? And, right. And how does that help you? So it's right. That's very old school, right? Of course, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Eddie talking about getting it from his father, that makes sense, right? That's been passed down. And it's so basic, but it's still applicable. It's still all these things we've talked about with rituals and the illusion, it's just part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And you touched on it a little, right? You obviously do keep an eye on the current product, right? You mm-hmm. named, you know, you knew Billy Corgan on the NWA, and you talked about mm-hmm. AEW. So the list of wrestlers that you have trained, it's just unreal, right? It's just this unbelievable list. When you watch modern wrestling and you see your fingerprints because of that, I'm not even going to, you know, I know you're humble. We're not going to talk about the influence, but just the training. What's that like to watch and say, oh yeah, I trained that person. I trained that person. I trained, you know, it's like, this is virtually my show here. Right. You have to have a unique eye to watch this product from that aspect.
Yes. And I feel a mixture of feelings when I have that exact phenomenon that you just described, like, oh, those are all my people there. So on the one hand, right, I do kind of feel like, all right, like something I gave to them helped springboard them to where they are now. And like, that's cool. Like, there's no getting around it. That's cool. But I'd be lying if I said there isn't also a part of me that's a little jealous sometimes. When I see that, I'm like, oh man, I wish that was me. Yeah. I wish I was up there doing that thing. So, and I feel a mixture. The truth is, every once and again, right, when I see my people putting on like a really epic match, I'm like, I'm proud of them. And that makes me proud of some of the work I put into building them. Sure. And it's a little bit of all those things. And then there's the part of me that switches into coach mode at the end. And I think, well, let's say if after that match, what if Claudio calls me up and says, did you watch on Wednesday? Do you have any feedback for me? I got to be able to tell him something. I've got to be able to say, you know, you missed this or this needs to be tweaked or whatever. It's great and all, I think, to be able to hand out feedback to people that is affirming and uplifting. But the truth is, if you really want to function at the very, very pinnacle, you've got to constantly be looking for the elements in your game which can be improved. And that's where I bring my coaching eye, or as I call it, my analytical goggles. When somebody who's, you know, plying their trade up at the corporate level of wrestling and they're on television every week calls up and asks for feedback, they don't want a pat on the back. Mm-hmm. They are not calling to be like, aren't I great? They're like, they're literally saying to me, the second line after how are you is, tell me everything I just did wrong.
Yep.
So I want to both watch it sometimes with my fan eyes and just love what these people are making. Because you're right, my fingerprints are there. And then I must shift and put on my analytical goggles as well. Because if the phone rings 5 minutes after that match, I got to be able to say, you're not paying attention to your footwork or whatever, you know, whatever that thing is. So yeah. It's all those things.
Yeah, well, I'm going to push on you a little further because you said you had mixed emotions, right? There's two sides of this.
Yes.
And that was leading to my next question. So I'm going to put you on the spot. You talked about how, you're not a prideful person, right? You don't view things that way. But you've done some obviously great things in the career. So personally satisfying things in the career, wrestling Jushin Liger, wrestling mm-hmm. Eddie Guerrero, things that are important to you as a performer. You've done things that are important to you as a trainer. Mm-hmm. Which side holds, as you sit right now in your mind, which holds more weight for you? Which do you feel more satisfied to think about? when you watch almost your children on TV doing these things, or when you think about what you personally accomplished, does one, or is it still just that depends on my mood and where I'm at for the day?
It really is. It's day to day. And you put it very well there. I appreciate that because I call them my kids. When I refer to them, when I'm telling stories, you know, I call them my kids. There are days where that really is the thing. There are days where, like, just above where we're at right now, sometimes I look up, my 10 wrestling books are there. And I think that's something. That's some kind of something or other. you know, there's other times where somebody will share a clip with me of like, hey, here's you wrestling Johnny Saint in front of a sold out crowd in Germany. And I think, how did I ever get there? Man, this is kind of amazing. And it is, it's just kind of day to day. And there are a lot of days where I really wake up and I feel like, I'll give you a real example. This is from, I guess it was Sunday morning I woke up and I had a comment over on my YouTube channel, right? So I've got maybe 500, give or take, wrestling tutorials over there until we make it. And there was someone that was like, bro, nobody's ever heard of you. I have no clue who you are. Who are you to be talking like this about wrestling? And it's a good reminder to me that, like, I still got work to do. So, yeah, it's cool that I can be like, oh, look, those are my books and those are my kids and blah, blah, right? And there's a time and a place for that. But every once and again, I'm woken up in the morning by somebody else who's just like, you are a nobody. And it makes me feel like I better get to work.
Well, right. And that literally that's where I was going to bring this all home. Mike Quackenbush does not strike me as the kind to rest on any laurels, training or wrestling, right? You talked about your books. You've hosted several podcasts. You do your thing on you're constantly doing something, right? You're constantly working. But the thing I wish there were so many other guys who would transition in their careers to that point of not trying to seek past fame, but to give back to the business, right? Because that's the progression that it should be. You should get to that point of, okay, I can't do this as much anymore. So now let's take what I have gained from my years, and let's work to give it to someone else and move this forward. But then, but you hear the horror stories of guys that, you know, have other approaches. So what I want to do now, as we're winding down, is talk to us about some of these things. Plug what you need to plug. You talked about your YouTube channel. Your books are out there all over Amazon, right? If they look up Mike Quackenbush, they're all out there. Kindle versions, print versions, Audible versions. So let everybody know, because there might be, you know, there could be wrestlers listening and say, oh, you have tutorials. How do they find those? How do they tap into that Mike Quackenbush knowledge?
So thank you very much for that. Yes, my YouTube channel is called Till We Make It. And currently, like I said, a little over 500 wrestling tutorials. And part of the reason why I feel very confident about just putting this information out there is, and I'll tell you some of the resistance I had early on. The project's 5 years old now. The feeling was like, you shouldn't just expose all of this. And I think we opened the Pandora's box on that sort of stuff a long time ago. I believe that when really ardent fans get an inside look at how challenging wrestling is to make, they will only respect it and love it more. It is not a matter of, oh, well, now that I understand this, I don't want to watch it anymore, or this is dumb, or I don't know what that fear is. We all love this same weird thing, and it's okay to love it, and it's okay to want to know as much about it as your brain wants to hold, whatever that means for you. So if you want to load your brain up, I got a whole bunch of stuff for you over Until We Make It on YouTube. And then this year, I really started to also share that same type of stuff across my other platforms. I had always been very reluctant to ever engage like on Facebook or Instagram or whatever, or had to start a TikTok because I guess that's how you reach people. Right. But yeah, I want to get that information out there, because whenever I see something like, have you heard about, very recently, there was an upstart wrestling company in Africa called Soft Ground Wrestling.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Absolutely, I have.
Right? There's a story like that every week. Last week's version of this, you may know, they did wrestling matches on Mount Everest. Did you hear about this?
Mm-hmm. I did, yeah.
Right? Right? There's three wrestling companies in Nepal. Where everywhere, wrestling is sprouting up. People want to be able to make it their own way, with their own style, infused with their own culture and imagination. And they deserve every chance to make that. If, whether it's my books, whether it's the stuff on YouTube, whether I'm out there training constantly, whatever it might be, I'm hoping that out there is the next awesome thing in wrestling. And if I can provide them with the right tool at the moment they need it to make that happen, then this is worthwhile. Yeah. I'm in a unique place in that because I, like we mentioned a while ago, right? I have no TV equity to cash in, right? When I'm on a poster these days, not that I wrestle all that often anymore, but when I do, it doesn't say former WWE superstar underneath, right? I have none of that equity to cash in. Yeah. This is the next step forward for me, is to supply the tools to the incoming class so they can make wrestling even more awesome and hopefully not have to make the mistakes along the way that I did.
Yeah. And all these things we've discussed, right? And they're not all necessarily new, right? These are as old as the businesses that you talked about.
Yeah.
All this wrestling and on these different locations and doing these odd, that was at its core is what the territory system was. Each territory had its own flavor, put their own stamp on it. And I've long said, right, back in the day, people would, they'd poster towns and they'd do this and that. Well, now it's social media. That's your postering is utilizing. I mean, it's all the same principles. It's just taking them and bringing them to the new era. And that's what I like with, you know, what I've read of you in our discussion is you have those principles, but you're wise enough to know this is how you utilize them. And they're still there, right? The curtain's open. Everybody knows, right? Kayfabe's whatever. Right. But the storytelling and the emotion, it's still prominent. It's still useful. Mm-hmm. You can still use it. That's not kayfabe. That's very real, is those people's emotions. And you're still able to do that if done right. So I urge anybody, wrestler or not, to go and check this out because it's fascinating. And hopefully they'll go and check your YouTube channel out and your other things and your books and get that perspective of it. And but Mike, it's been an honor to talk to you. You're a very humble man. I don't think you I know you're not prideful, but you have accomplished so much. And
well, thank you.
And I'm a punk rock fan. I'm a rock and roll fan. And like you mentioned earlier, I love that pro. You know, I love that you did it without that corporate machine. Whether you set out to do that or not,
right?
You still have influenced the business because you said, okay, well, if this is not there for me, okay, then I'll take this road. It may not be as easy. It may not be as glamorous, but I'm going to plug away and do it my path and do it because of the passion and the love. So I appreciate you giving me the time, and it's very much an honor to talk to you. And I urge people to go check out all your evidence. Do you have a central location for people? You said you're on Instagram or what? Do they just look up Mike Quackenbush on all those platforms?
You know, I should build one, you know, I should build a website or something. But if you find me on YouTube, everything connects through there. That really is kind of like my central hub. And I mean, there's a new video every day and a full length one every single Friday. So if you constantly need that kind of like input of knowledge, it's there. And after hearing me talk enough, you'll know where to find my books. Like you'll know where all that stuff is waiting for you.
Sure.
But I appreciate that very much. And what a pleasure it is to speak with someone that's such a knowledgeable fan of wrestling.
Well, thank you.
Right. It's so clear that you really do know your stuff. And that's so refreshing because, well, there's certainly a whole lot to be said, right, about what's happened in wrestling this year in the last 3 to 5 years. Like you said, there are some tenets of wrestling that are decades and decades old. They worked then. They just need to be applied now. And while they might be updated or they might evolve in slight ways, there's a reason why wrestling has persisted for over 150 years here in the United States. And it will continue to thrive because we've got great, passionate fans and people who love it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you, Mike. Again, I appreciate your time and talking to me. Hopefully I didn't go over and hold you up from what you got to go to next. So, all right. Well, we'll keep in touch. I'll let you know when this is due to air. I mean, I've got a few interviews ahead of you, so it might be just a few weeks. And I will look up, I will drop your YouTube link in the show notes.
Oh, thank you.
So that people can very easily click that and go there. So, but I appreciate your time and talking to you, and hopefully we'll stay in touch.
Mm-hmm. This was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mike.
Gene Jackson here, inviting you to join us for the Retro Wrestling Review Podcast, where each week I'm joined by guest co-host to review and discuss old school pro wrestling. Right now, we're doing week by week reviews of USWA Memphis from 1993. We have an audio version of the podcast as well as a video version if you want to check out the clips of the show we're talking about. It's a lot of fun, so for this and a lot of other great wrestling content, check out WrestleCopia.com. That's WrestleCopia.com.
The following podcast has been paid for by Perched on the Top Rope.
What's going on, everybody? I'm former Dirt Sheet writer from Sports Kita, Ringside News, The Sportster, The Richest, and Daily DDT. I am Lee Walker. And ladies and gentlemen, I have a podcast named Perched on the Top Rope. We are on Chartable's Top 250, and we have several interviews with the names of Booker T, Kevin Nash, The Young Bucks, and all sorts of current superstars from AEW, NWA, MLW, legends from WCW, ECW, and over 30 WWE Hall of Famers. I hope you come and check us out. We are everywhere, and everywhere podcasts can be found. It's Perched on the Top Rope. And if you're not in the mood to listen to those interviews, you can go to youtube.com at Perched on the Top Rope and watch those interviews also. Fans, remember, spoiler freeze, the way to be. I'm out.
All right. Thank you to Mike Quackenbush for coming on and chatting with me. Hopefully we can touch base with him again later. Again, man, that was just, it was just a wonderful interview, right? It was so fascinating. Just so much knowledge there. I could have chatted with hours more with Mike. Guys, make sure you go and follow me on X at the Dave Dynasty. And like mentioned earlier, go check out all of the WrestleCopia network of podcasts. Next episode, I will have Hollywood John Tatum on the show. Chatted with John. We talk about Michael Hayes, Missy Hyatt, Jack Victory, his time at World Class, the UWF Global, and much, much more. Another great chat with another classic wrestler. So don't miss that. I have some great episodes coming up in the future with some really, really wonderful interviews, including some rare first-time podcast guests. Plus, there'll be more AWA Deep Dive episodes coming. And much, much more right here as we try to preserve, highlight, and shine a spotlight on the history of professional wrestling. So be sure to subscribe and never miss an episode. Guys, thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting. Thank you for all your interactions on social media. And wherever you go, whatever you do, until next episode, be good, be safe, and always keep on growing.
Fans, we brought you All-Star Championship Wrestling. This is Sam Manager thanking you for being with us and saying until next time, so long, everyone.